What's the NPR show that celebrates kids who dream big?
Well, my dream is to play Rhapsody in Blue with an orchestra.
I want to have a music studio in Italy.
I want to play in a major symphony.
I'm pretty much going to solve the theory of everything.
It's From the Top, the showcase for the best young classical musicians in the country. Join me, Christopher O'Reilly, for NPR's From the Top.
Friday afternoons at 2, Sunday nights at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
Promo for From the Top. It's a new program to Utah Public Radio. It's been going about 10 years. NPR program has a wide audience and features pre-collegiate classical artists, some wonderful artists, as you've no doubt noticed. If you've tuned into the show Fridays at 2 and Sunday evenings at 9 o'clock. And as you've also heard, there's a big event on the campus of Weber State University. It's a live taping From the Top. Some wonderful young Utah musicians and musicians from other areas will be performing tonight at 7:30, and tickets are still available for that. They're only $10, and you can go to our website, upr.org, for more information and to purchase those tickets. We're going to talk about From the Top and these great young artists in the first half of the program. The second half, by the way, we'll talk about another round of base closures. We're all on tenterhooks some 10, 15 years ago with the last big round of base closures. Hill Field, not far from here, escaped that. We'll be talking with former Congressman Jim Hansen and with Tage Flint with Utah Defense Alliance. That's the second half of the program. We begin with From the Top. By the way, Lewiston State Bank has provided support for this program. We're coming to you live from Ogden, from Lampros Hall on the campus of Weber State University. I'm joined in this part of the program by the program host, Christopher O'Reilly. Thanks for coming in.
Tom, great to be with you.
And by the show's co-founding executive producer, Gerald Slavitt. Thanks for coming in.
Nice to be here.
Let me start with you, Mr. Slavitt. This apparently was your idea, a show that would feature young musicians.
Yes, it was. We believe that we ought to celebrate our young artists in the same way that we celebrate our young athletes. Throughout the country, you're a superstar already in middle school if you're a great athlete, and yet you might be a young person who just won an international cello competition at the age of 12, beating out 20-year-olds, and you don't even want your peers to know that you play classical music. We thought it was about time to change that around with a national program, and that's why we created this show, and really came about almost as an accident.
Mm-hmm. Has it had the effect, do you think, that you wanted it to have?
Absolutely. There is no question, particularly now with social media, that these kids, when they're on the show, they blast it to everyone they know, and they've begun to be celebrated, I think, in a very different way than was the case 12 years ago. This is our 12th season.
Now, young athletes, sometimes it's like a one-in-a-million shot. They go on to fame other places. That's also part of this, not the fame, but maybe a foundation for a career. Do you have alumni that go on to careers?
Oh, absolutely, several. And the interesting thing is not only do they go on to great careers in music, but many in music education and many in other fields. These kids, you can't play at the level at which we present these kids without having learned discipline, passion, and focus. And if you have learned those qualities, you'll probably succeed at whatever you do. And so last week, Chris and I were talking, and he was singling out a young lady who was on our show several years ago, and we couldn't decide if she was going to play piano or violin. So she was on the show playing the violin for an encore. She played the piano. And what's so special about her, she's now doing stem cell research at Harvard University. Now, balance that out with some of the kids. Carol Jansch, is that how you pronounce her name, is the principal tuba of the Philadelphia Orchestra. I think the only woman to hold that position in the first chair. And there's Matthew Mucky, who's a trumpet player in the New York Philharmonic. There are many, many kids. And as I say, also, I think because of the experience they've had on From the Top, where education is very important to us, a lot of these kids go on and decide, you know, rather than aim for a career as a soloist, I want to go out and spread the gospel of music.
Let me, before I bring in Christopher O'Reilly, music wasn't your field, right? You were in developing?
I have never been a musician at all. I'm entrepreneurial by nature. I started out again late in life, actually, in theater. And then I spent a year in South America as a goodwill ambassador in the arts. And then I became a real estate developer. During that time, my daughter was in the New England Conservatory Youth Philharmonic Orchestra with Ben Zander, the conductor, and they were getting into trouble with an international tour, and so I volunteered to try to rescue the tour for them. And then I went on to, as a volunteer, to do their international tours for the next 16 years, and that's when this idea emerged. I had realized that these kids were really great kids when you hang out with them, and the fact that they didn't want their friends to know that they even played, that had to change. And Jordan Hall, the beautiful performance hall at New England Conservatory, had been recently renovated. They were looking for new uses, and Jennifer Hurley-Wales, who's my co-CEO, and I, she took me to a meeting. She was working at the conservatory at that time, and we were standing outside after the meeting, and she mentioned that she liked old-fashioned radio, and I said, and let's do it focused on kids. And she said, what do you mean? And boom, believe it or not, the whole show just popped right in my head, and I said, well, let's do it, because no one will ever believe us. And literally a month or so later, we did a couple of pilots.
Mm. And the rest, as they say, is history. And this is some 700 stations and thousands of people listening, not only on NPR stations, but on PBS. How did Christopher Riley get involved? This, you know, he's an established, well-known pianist, has his own concert career.
Well, we did those pilots with yours truly pretending to be a host. And when people listened to him, they said, well, you know, maybe there is an idea here, but you better get a real host. And at that time, Christopher had been featured on a CBS Sunday Morning piece. And Jennifer and I were both struck by the fact that he sort of dispelled the stereotype of the classical musician. They filmed a part of him jogging. They talked about a lot of the music that he listened to, which was not at all classical. And we knew that we wanted someone who could relate to the kids and who did dispel that stereotype. And so he had also just updated his resume and biography at New England Conservatory, where he was a graduate. We called him and said, come on in for an interview. We interviewed him. And it was the first interview, and I said to Jennifer, look, you know, seems good enough to me. We could spend the next 6 months searching, or let's just give it a go and see how it goes. And he's been the first host and the still host and still doing a great job, and more than just doing a great job, forever growing in his position.
You just joined us. We're coming to you live from the campus of Weber State University, live from Ogden. On the occasion, today is the live taping of From the Top. We're glad to be participating with this. From the Top goes around the country and features young musicians, pre-collegiate classical musicians. We'll have some wonderful Utah musicians involved. Later in the program, we'll hear from Trenton Chong, who I interviewed earlier today. He's from Logan, and are welcome to come to the concert, 7:30 tonight on the campus of Weber State University. Go to upr.org for more information. Let me bring in Christopher Riley. So, Gerald Slavitt, others come to you, say, we've got this show. What did you think?
Well, I was, you know, in my house in Los Angeles, and Jerry called me, and I, as we mentioned, I've been touring as a concert pianist for many, many years, but I had been watching sort of a winnowing away of the classical music audience with really not too great efforts to try and revitalize interest in classical music. There were things like, you know, doing a pops concerts for kids and having the conductor in a Superman costume and have him fly in from the wings, and that was fine. But, you know, then when you have the fourth grader show up tomorrow third and they're wondering where Superman is, that really doesn't do the job there. Or making symphony brochures that look like Harlequin romances. I mean, this really seemed to be a really good idea because, and again, Jerry pointed out our commitment to education. It's really incalculable, the power and effect of, as we do with every one of our shows, our kids get together and talk about arts leadership. cultural leadership and talk about how they can bring music into their communities, how they can bring it to their peers, and imagine, you know, a symphony orchestra musician going in and playing for a bunch of sixth graders, and then imagine a sixth grader of world-class quality going in and playing for his or her peers. The effect is phenomenal, not only in that, I mean, it's not just a matter of proselytizing for another violist in the world, but to be able to say, have a kid say, well, this kid has only been playing for a few years, I could do that, or more importantly, this kid is an example of how, if I apply myself, I can do anything.
Mm. And the show is, it's not only the kids performing, but you have extensive conversations with them.
Well, yeah, because the thing is, I mean, you know, for many people, this music is unfamiliar. And there's also an impression that if you're not into classical music 24/7, and if you're going to clap in the wrong place, or if you don't know the names, dates, and places of the composers, et cetera, we don't want you in the audience. It's a terrible impression to have left. I mean, we respect the music a great deal, but much like the variety programs that we've all grown up with, there is something to be said about getting to know the performers. And once you get next to them to the point of saying, gee, they're just like me, only they do this different thing, then you're going to give the music a chance. And so we do an extensive pre-interview process with all the kids on the show. And so virtually everything that happens on the show is not out of the minds of, you know, smart-alecky middle-aged types like me, but really what the kids have told us about. And there's a lot of material, and they have really interesting stories to tell.
Let's hear just a little bit of a clip. This is from a recent show. Christopher Riley, the host, talking with 11-year-old cellist Noah Lee about how Lee's friends think he talks too much. We'll hear this clip and talk about it.
Now, Noah, not only are you a passionate performer, you're one of the happiest 11-year-olds I've met. I mean, you like so many things in your life, like talking. You like to talk a lot, right?
Yes, I especially like talking.
Your friends kind of get after you for talking too much, or your family, or anything
like
that?
Yeah, they kind of get angry sometimes. They just tell me to be quiet.
How could anybody get angry at you?
I don't know.
you're a ball of fire, and great to be around.
That's Christopher Riley with 11-year-old cellist Noah Lee talking about how Lee's friends think he talks too much. I don't know if you remember that conversation. Is there any one of those that stand out to you?
Well, I don't think it's a matter of standing out so much. I mean, what we try to do is shed a very strong and illuminating light on all our kids. And so sometimes, as in this case, you know, you have a sort of a humorous sort of situation. Something that used to make me very nervous early on would be one of our kids who would be so focused on their music, you'd not get anything other than a one-word answer out of them. And it used to make me very, very nervous. And then I realized, well, no, the impression that's going out to the broadcast audience is, gee, this kid is really concentrated on his music. And that was yet another reason to give the music a chance. So we really, I think some people do get the impression that we're looking for, you know, cellists / you know, stand-up comedians, but nothing could be further from the truth. We're really looking to illuminate each one of their personalities in their own way.
Mm. Although some of the kids are very funny, very lively. You
We do go for liveliness. Yeah. We do encourage them to be lively.
Yeah, yeah. Jared Slavitt, any of the venues stand out to you? I was watching a video of a fairly recent performance. It was on the beach, I think, in New Jersey. There was a quartet who was playing out there just on the boardwalk, it seemed like.
You know, the thing that I find so amazing is that wherever you go in this country, I mean, wherever you go, in every nook and cranny, there are interested listeners and people interested in music. And I will confess that the smaller the community, the more I like the venue, because clearly, you know, their choices of what's available to them in the arts is much more limited than, say, in Boston, New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, L.A., San Francisco, wherever. And it's a delight coming into a smaller place like Lubbock, Texas, or El Paso, Texas, or wherever. And that you contrast that with coming into the Opera House in Dallas or the Houston Opera House, these magnificent venues with 3,000 seats virtually filled. So I can't say that there's any particular place that stands out, except I do love the passion, the uninhibited passion that the very small community audiences bring.
One of the things that Jerry hints at there a little bit as regards, you know, all of the talent from around the country is that when we started the program, the idea was, well, when you run out of the kids from Interlochen or Idlewild or, you know, Juilliard Prep or New England Prep, what are you going to do? And concurrent with that conversation is the one about, well, the place of music in public schools and how that's usually the first thing to get cut. And what we have found is that regardless of local community involvement in music education, there has been and remains to this day an extraordinarily strong and vital community of private music instructors, such that any small town in the country, you want to learn how to be a first-class tenor or bassoon player, it's possible. And we hear these kids every week, and it's just an extraordinarily moving testament to the dedication of those private school, private music instructors.
Let's hear another clip. This is just to show you the artistry, the virtuosity of fairly young people. And this is 17-year-old Stephanie Block. This is from a fairly recent show, performing Walton's Viola Concerto and accompanied by Christopher Riley on the piano. Let's hear this. It's about a minute and a half or so of viola and piano music. From the NPR program, From the Top, that it was Stephanie Block, 17 years old, performing Walton's Viola Concerto, accompanied by the program host, Christopher Riley, on the piano. If you just joined us, we're talking about From the Top with the host, Christopher Riley, and with the co-founding executive producer, Gerald Slavitt. And the program is taping, live taping. You'll hear that the first week in April, and that taping is tonight at 7:30 on the campus of Weber State University. So if you'd like to come down, tickets still available. You can get those. $10 a piece is all they go for. And see those wonderful young musicians, Christopher Riley, on stage. And then you can see the edited form of the program on PBS and NPR later on. And that's happening tonight. And UPR is participating in that. And our thanks to the good folks at From the Top, good folks at Weber State University as well. We're coming to you live from Ogden, from Lampros Hall on the Weber State University campus with Christopher Riley and Gerald Slavitt in this part of the program. I wanted to talk, Christopher Riley, about the young musicians. We just heard some virtuosic performance. Obviously very accomplished violists there along with you.
Oh, and appropriate to our education conversation, that was actually a show we taped at a convention of the National Educational Association, the NEA, not to be confused with what Sarah Palin thinks the NEA is.
Okay.
there were, you know, 5,000 music teachers strong right there. That
yeah.
was a great event. Sorry, go on.
Obviously, a technical facility here.
Yeah.
But these are young musicians. They will mature in life. Mm-hmm. That will affect how they perform, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. You well know this from, you know, from your own career. Mm-hmm. So at this part in their journey, I wonder, how fully formed are these musicians?
Well, it's kind of amazing because these kids have much more access to lots of performances. I mean, back when I was in school, even in music school, a young violinist listening to the Mozart, you know, violin concerto would be listening to whoever Sony had out that month, and we really would have no impression of how that piece had been performed prior to that. Whereas now, kids are much more technically adept, technologically adept, so that, for instance, if they're working on a Bartok Rhapsody, they can actually YouTube a performance of Bartok playing with the violinist for whom he wrote it, Joseph Zsigety. So you have kids with enormous intellectual and musical curiosity and passion, rewarded by the incredible access to lots of performances. So the world has become a lot smaller, and so the ability to improve and the sort of way in which they can sort of see themselves against the general population of performers is really quite astounding. They really can, you know, put themselves, and particularly on our show, you know, when Jerry and Jennifer were shopping the show around, they went to various radio conferences and asked listeners to, you know, see if they could listen to three cellists and find out which one was Yo-Yo Ma and which one were two of our kids. And it was impossible.
Mm. You know, I think it's amazing that, you know, Christoph commented recently, when I think back to when we began the show, the quality of the music was extraordinarily high then. But now it's mind-blowing because, you know, Chris says that I think the kids appearing on our show today probably play at a level higher than most super professional classical musicians of 10 years ago. That's astounding. It also says the level of the professional musicians today is rather astounding. And it's similar in athletics. If you compare the athletic prowess of people today to just even 10 years ago, just amazing the level at which these kids play, and not only technically, although technically it's extraordinary, but the ability for them to really bring in the passion and the heart of the music. They haven't been jaded.
Mm-hmm. And you find this is, I talked about this a little bit with Trenton Chong, we'll have that conversation a little later on, but he talks about balance. He likes to hang out with his friends as well as practicing. I asked him about, it does take extraordinary dedication to get to this level.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of the kids are really wondering why they have to spend so much time at the piano or at their instrument, and you know, it's a great payoff, but it is a real sacrifice to a large degree, which is why, you know, we also encourage and also, you know, trumpet all of the major, you know, sort of communal musical experiences, the kids who are in choruses, so that they have their social life and their musical life at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that's a great way to introduce kids, not necessarily headset on having a musical career, but involving themselves in music sort of as a project, a pursuit of excellence, you know, something larger than the sum of its parts.
Mm-hmm. We're reaching near the end of our time. I just wondered, seems to be a broad range of instruments, including vocalists. What are some of the most unusual instruments you've had on the show?
We've had mandolin. We've had, there's a sort of
accordion.
There's that Russian accordion thing.
Right.
I don't even think it was called an accordion.
Right, it began with a B. I don't remember the name.
And we've had pipa players. We've had
bagpipes. Bagpipe ensemble.
What's the process to get on the show? Do you audition? Do you just listen to tapes?
All takes place at fromthetop.org. There are instructions on how to apply and where to send a tape and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Everybody, I've tried having friends, you know, recommend things to me. It doesn't happen. It all goes through the website.
Right. I want to ask you just here at the end, Christopher Riley. There's a quote from you here on your biography. There are only two kinds of music, good music and bad music.
That comes from Duke Ellington.
And yeah, that's right, a quote from Duke Ellington. And your latest CD, Out of My Hands, features music from Nirvana and R.E.M. and Radiohead. And I'm sure you've done Piazzolla, you've done a full range of music. Mm-hmm. Do you think things are heading more that way? What are the kids interested in?
I think the kids have a wide range of interests, and I always encourage them to play what they believe in. It's really not enough anymore to say you've got faster octaves than the next kid. A musical personality, one that is compelling to a large audience, is going to be not a matter of being a jack of all trades, but a culmination and a collection of different musical facets of a personality. We had one of our young women, Lauren Chippen, who was a violist on the show, who is now playing viola professionally in various LA ensembles, but she's also now the co-band leader of The Rentals and songwriter. So she's gotten into songwriter and, you know, songwriting and film playing and things like that. These kids have wide-ranging interests, and in this economy, it's important, I think, that they make themselves indispensable in whatever way they can. And the truer that is to their own musical passions, the better.
And who's coming up tonight? I think you have the list there. Who will be hearing from?
We have kind of an amazing, one of the more amazing performances of the finale of the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto I've ever heard. I mean, with or without orchestra, we actually have a pianist, Anastasia Magadamova. I better learn how to say that now. Who's also memorized the piano accompaniment, not only, you know, learning this horrible, you know, orchestral reduction, but an Aubrey Oliverson is the violinist, and these are two local kids from Orem and Murray, respectively. And it's just such an amazing experience being in the midst of these kids who spend most of their rehearsal time giggling, I think. It really comes across.
Not only there, how old are they there?
Oh, like 14.
13 or 14.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah.
We do have another performer. Trenton Chong will be with us tonight. And coming up here, we're going to hear my conversation about 5 minutes with him that I recorded a couple of days ago with young Logan musician Trenton Chong. So we'll wrap this up here, hear that brief interview, and then when we come back, we'll still be live from Ogden. We'll be talking about possible base closures. Another round is being talked about. And we'll be talking with former Congressman Jim Hansen and with Tage Flint, who is with the Utah Defense Alliance. Christopher Riley, thanks so much.
Thank you for having us.
He's the host of the program. The taping, again, is tonight at 7:30 on the campus of Weber State University. More information at upr.org. And co-founding executive producer, Gerald Slavitt, thanks so much.
Thank you. If you come tonight, it's a blast. Don't think of it even as a concert. It's an amazing experience seeing the whole thing put together.
We hope the people will, 7:30 tonight. Up next, my conversation recently with the young Logan pianist Trenton Chong, and then bass closures in the second half of the program.
On this part of the program, we're talking with Trenton Chong, who is a pianist. He'll be performing on the From the Top program this evening at 7:30, along with some other great young performers. Trenton Chong from the Logan area. And Trenton, thanks for joining us. Welcome to the program. This is, I would imagine, a pretty big event, opportunity to play for a national audience. How did you learn about From the Top?
Professor Hurst at the music department recommended me for this.
And I don't know, is there an audition process?
I don't think there is, but
apparently they must have heard something, and maybe they sent a tape or something, and they chose you.
Yeah, a tape.
Yeah, so that's got to be exciting. Are you nervous playing for an audience that big?
Not really. Nervousness isn't really that big of an issue for me.
Uh-huh. How long have you been playing?
I think about 9 years.
How old are you now?
I'm 14.
14. So you started pretty young. A lot of people do, I guess. But so I guess this takes talent, but also a lot of diligent practice.
Yeah, thanks.
So how many hours do you practice a day?
I don't know. On weekends, I just take however long I need, but on weekdays, sometimes I have homework, so I try to just get in an hour or so.
Yeah. So a lot on the weekends and fit it in around homework on the weekdays.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of your favorite pieces?
Well, I don't really have a specific favorite piece. I just like most of them.
Mm-hmm. Probably whatever you're playing lately.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. So what are you preparing to play for the From the Top event?
So I will be playing the third movement from the Ravel Sonatine.
Yeah. Now, have you played with, orchestras and such?
Well, I have played twice with the Utah Symphony in Salute to Youth, and once with the Utah Chamber Artists in the Beverly Sorensen Young Artists Concert.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's about it.
And so with the piano, you can go solo or with an ensemble. What do you prefer?
it really doesn't matter to me. It's performing is pretty much the same to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's still pretty cool either way.
Yeah. What do you get out of music? Well, you must love it to be this dedicated to it.
Yes. Well, basically, well, music just helps me relax. It makes me happy, and it's a fun thing to do, and it's a little more than just being a hobby.
Mm-hmm. So more than a hobby.
Yeah, a little more than a hobby.
Yeah, is this something you want to make your life's work?
Well, I want to try that. Yeah, that's a possibility.
Yeah, what's the backup plan if that doesn't work out?
You know what? I'm still thinking about that. Probably something like, I don't know, engineering or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. How did you get into the piano? You were fairly young at the time. You decided, I want to do this.
Yeah, pretty much. So we had an electric keyboard at home, and my parents, they found out that I could pick up some tunes by ear, I think. And so, yeah, and then I got signed up for piano lessons, and yeah, I really liked it.
Hmm. Now, a lot of people get signed up for piano lessons, and not everybody gets to this level. What does that take?
Patience. you need to be patient.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, yeah, I'm lucky to have a really good teacher right now.
Who's your teacher?
Professor Amano at the university.
Oh, yes, well
known. Lots of patience and a really good teacher. Yeah, that's pretty much what it is.
So what is your process? How do you prepare for a performance like the From the Top event?
Well, I practice. I make sure I do what I need in time, and that usually works out for me.
Mm-hmm. In this program, there will be some conversation on stage with the host. I guess that, are you nervous about that?
Not very.
It sounds like you've got some good preparation. You're ready.
Yeah, pretty much. You kind of get used to it.
Yeah, I would imagine. So, what do you like to do apart from piano?
I like reading and hanging out with my friends, and yeah.
I guess when you're this dedicated to one, to one thing, you got to have a little balance.
Yeah.
And so hanging out with your friends and reading it provides you some of that.
Yeah.
Well, we'll look forward to your performance. That's Thursday night, and you'll be performing what piece again?
The third movement from the Ravel Sonatine.
And there'll be some other extraordinary young musicians there as well. I guess you probably look forward to seeing them perform.
Yeah, I guess I am.
Well, Trenton Chung, he'll be performing on the From the Top event tonight. On the campus of Weber State University. Trenton, a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, same here.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan, now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah today. I'm Tom Williams. We're coming to you live from Ogden on the campus of Weber State University from Lampros Hall. If you'd like to know exactly where we are. And in this part of the program, we're going to talk about something that Representative Rob Bishop of Utah says everyone should be worried. He says it's too early to know any of the details, but everyone should be worried. He's talking about base closures. And it looks like another round of base closures might be coming down the road, although there's significant opposition in Congress, as Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta found recently. Secretary Panetta says that although he's been through this pain, he says as a congressman, there was a base closed in his district. He feels like that's the only way to make infrastructure reductions that are needed, in his view, in the defense budget. We're going to talk about possible round of base closures, what that might mean for Hill Air Force Base, with former Congressman Jim Hansen. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
and with Tage Flint, who is president of Utah Defense Alliance. Thank you.
Good morning.
Tell us, first of all, what's the Utah Defense Alliance?
It's a volunteer group that is made up of business leaders and other community leaders around Hill Air Force Base, and they're here primarily to promote the positives from the base and what it brings to the community, and it's also here to help when it comes time in the public forum to get the word out how valuable the base is not only to Utah but to the national defense.
Hmm. Let me turn first to the congressman. Congressman, you were, I believe, in Congress for the first couple of rounds of base closures. One round later on, you were on the Base Realignment Closure Commission.
Yes, I helped write the original bill on base closing that happened in the 80s. Dick Armey was the chief sponsor, and a few of us helped him. Then we had a round in 91 where Dugway was put on the list, and the possibility of Hill going on the list at that time. In 95, we had another round where all five of the air logistics centers were put on the list, and two of them were closed. Fortunately, Hill ducked that bullet. What we didn't duck was Bill Clinton thinking that he wanted to move 95% of Hill Field to California. I got a little political there for a while. So we put language in the defense authorization bill that prohibited him from doing that, and fortunately we were successful. Then when I got out of Congress, I was asked to be a base closing commissioner, and for 2 years we went around America and we closed 22 bases and realigned 33.
So when you were writing this legislation, involved in that, this was an attempt to take some of the politics out of this? Was it to have a commission? Because this is obviously is very political, and each congressman's not going to want the base closed in his district.
Well, one of the reasons for putting together a base closing thing is to get politics out of it. I know that's almost impossible to a certain extent, but we tried. There should be no congressman, no governor, no senator, no anybody with any clout. We don't expect the governor of the state of Utah to call up and say, take my base off that. If he did that, he should go to jail because he'd be in violation of the Ethics in the Government Act. And I was chairman of the Ethics Committee and I'm more than willing to send him to jail. But be that as it may, when it comes down to the idea, in this particular instance, the President of the United States stood down there in McClellan and he said, there's a lot more voters in California than there is in Utah. And besides that, I lost in 1992. He's very open about it. And he said, I will think of a way around the law, which is kind of an interesting thing for a president to say. And in that case, we had to put the language in the defense authorization bill that forced him to obey the law and keep Hill open. A lot of people don't realize all the intricacies that went on in that. 2005, it was just the idea we went around and looked at the bases that were suggested to be closed. Keep in mind that the Base Closing Commission does not have to follow the directions that come out of the Pentagon. They can do whatever they want to do. So they can put a base on there that wasn't there before.
Let me ask each of you, of course, the overarching principle here is reduction in the defense budget. Do you think the defense budget needs to be reduced at this point?
Yeah, I think so. I think the Air Force would tell you that they think it ought to be cut to a certain extent. The question is, and when you talk about Utah, we have one Air Force base, and what kind of cuts are going to come in that whole scheme? I think the risk here always is that there'll be a disproportional cut coming to Utah versus the Air Force in general. And with Hill Air Force Base being the largest employer in the state of Utah, we're talking about big-time economic impact if that were to happen. I should say probably that we will come about this from a community standpoint as an asset that Hill is to national defense, not so much that it's going to hurt us Utahns, so therefore you can't close it. Mm-hmm. I think that's a poor argument.
And the former argument that you're going to advance is probably a stronger one to present nationally.
Correct. Right. Yes.
Congressman, the overall question, do you think defense budget should be cut at this point?
Well, just recently, the Air Force went through a reduction. As Sage can point out to you, Utah probably ducked the bullet there, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I think they lost, 200 and something jobs is all. And so they got out pretty well. I think a lot of that is to the benefit of a young man by the name of Bill Kristol, who works for Orrin Hatch, and Orrin Hatch wading in on that one. And in my opinion, they did a really fine job in making sure Hill didn't get hit any harder than that. But back to your basic question, should there be a cut? Absolutely. I've traveled all over the world for the military because I was second-ranking guy in the Armed Services Committee and on the Intelligence Committee. And we have little bases everywhere. Sure, we're not going to go take Ramstein out in Germany, and we'll probably have to stay in Korea, but we've got bases that would do nothing. And we're basically there because they want us there for ceremony things. And they, besides that, we employ 1,500 of their people. It's good for their economy. And so you start taking all those little ones, and it adds up to millions and billions of dollars. So I was talking to the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, a dear friend of mine who I served with for many years, and he said they can do that on their own. They don't need a base closing commission. They should go out, they should start closing some of those foreign bases and get that money back to the states so we can use it here for ours, because we really – I think that it bothers me when I see my friend Leon Panetta getting into the idea that he wants to start closing some armaments. He wants to start cutting back, for example, the F-16 is going out, the A-10 is going out, the B-52, which has been flying for 50 years, is down to just the G models. The B-1 has been changed from nuclear to conventional. And so you start going through this thing, we're really going through a reduction. At the same time, there's a possibility that we could be in two wars. We have been saying we want to be strong enough that we can fight two wars. Well, I don't know if we're going to get to that point. And if Ahmadinejad decides he wants to close the Straits of Hormuz, what are we going to do now? You're going to go down and sink their whole navy? I think it's not a bad idea, but maybe that's what's going to happen. We've got to have a strong defense. And I'm a little upset, and of course I'm a Republican, but I'm really upset with what I see happening with this administration, thinking that we can take our military down to the size that we not only probably can't defend our own country, but we can't help some of our allies.
Let me quote you, the Secretary, and you've addressed part of this, but I want to have you address this further. Secretary Panetta, and this is a recent testimony, I believe, in front of the Senate Armed Services Committee, he talks about the pain that the base closures went through in his own district. And then he goes on to say, and yet it's the only effective way to achieve needed infrastructure savings. So he's believing that there are infrastructure savings that are needed. Base realignment and closure commission is the only way to do that.
Well, there is, but it's a long way down the line. As we close these bases, it takes 4 or 5 years to do it, and it costs money to close a base. What a lot of people don't realize, and I don't mean to use this as an example, but Hill Field has put Falcon Hill in. They've put a lot of money in that thing. So people say to me all the time, well, there's no way in the world we'd close Hill. I feel like saying, let me give you some examples. That doesn't mean a thing. The first criteria that you look at is the use of the military. So if they decided in a base closing, we don't need this air logistics centers because we got two and we move it there and we don't need this one, they wouldn't care if you put $10 billion in it, you'd close it. So that isn't the criteria. Criteria is better is what the defense of America, and it's got the Utah test and training range, it's got a good place to fly, it's got a great workforce. That type of thing is what Tate and his gang will be pushing, the benefits of why it's good and why it's working, and they've always done a good job since they used to be Save Hill back in 91 and then 95 and 2005. I've been very impressed. They have kind of led the nation on how to do it, and I think they will continue that. I hope they don't lose focus of it. You know, a lot of them get into economic development, this other stuff. They got to focus in on saving the base.
And if you just joined us, we're talking about another possible round of base closures. That's ideas being floated by the Secretary of Defense, and it's I believe it's in the President's budget. So that might be coming down the pike, and of course, if that happens, possible effect to Hill Air Force Base. We're talking with Tej Flint, who's president of Utah Defense Alliance, and with former Congressman Jim Hansen. Let me turn to Tej Flint. Let me just have you outline, and we saw some bases closed, some massive realignments with some of the previous realignments. What would the effect of a closure of Hill have on the economy of Utah?
Well, it's tremendous. We had a study that was commissioned here about 7 or 8 years ago by the University of Utah that helped us in trying to quantify what the impacts to a community like this. And if you want to draw a line up and down the Wasatch Front, you can start seeing the impacts. If the base were actually to close and we were to lose the some 24,000 jobs that were available or are now currently at the base, starting down in Salt Lake County, they did it in terms of recovery rate. And in Salt Lake County, it would take 10 years to recover economically if Hill Air Force Base, a whole county away, were to close. If you get to Davis County, it would take 25 to 30 years for their economy to recover. And that's probably on the conservative side. When you get to Weber County, it's very interesting. When you get to Weber County, there was indeterminate amount of years it would take to for the county to recover. And in other words, we're not sure that we would ever recover in Weber County if the base were to close right down and go away. So we're talking about large impacts to the state economically, something that no one in charge would even want to talk about.
Mm. Let me ask you, and then I'll ask Congress as well, how likely do you think it is in the next few years we'll have another round of base realignment and closures?
I think it's very likely. It may not happen in 2013 when Secretary Panetta asked for it to be done, but I think it's inevitable. And the reason that is the defense cuts are inevitable, and base closures, it has to go through Congress in order to close a base, and so I think that's the means that they'll eventually get to. The question is how widespread it'll be, over which services will it be, all of them. And I think Hill Air Force Base, as the Congressman already mentioned, is in a good position. I think we need to reiterate that all the time. We're in a very good position. And there are only three air logistic commands left, and the Air Force has repeatedly said that they need all three. Our workforce is outstanding here. It is second to none. And the flying missions are very well equipped here with the testing range out on the other side of the Great Salt Lake. It just seems like we're well positioned. That doesn't mean that we should fall asleep at the switch, though, and we're going to have to do all we can to promote those kinds of ideals.
Congress, how likely do you think another round is?
I agree that it probably won't happen in 2013. I don't know if they could gear up fast enough to do it. But do we need one? Absolutely we need one. I'm not saying Hill, but I could name 20 bases that we keep open, and I don't know why. And it really bothers me that we do. And we should have closed many more when I was a commissioner, and I won't go into why that didn't happen. If I ever serve on that again, we'd close a lot more bases. 2013 is pretty close. Talking to Buck McKeon, the chairman of the committee, he's against doing that. But the chairman of the committee over on the Senate side is Carl Levin. Carl is all for it. So this is the mechanics of how it works. Carl Levin puts in the defense authorization bill on his side that it's in there. Buck doesn't put it on his side. It goes to conference committee. Who wins? And I'm of the opinion that he would win. So Buck has to gear up, and he's got to have some hearings on it, and they've got to do some work. Where is it that anyone can affect it? You can affect it from the time it starts until they put it in cement and they choose the commissioners. Then the commissioners can change it if they want to. But we changed some that weren't on there and decided to do it. Now, somebody may say, well, we can move all of the airframes to Warner Robins because they do good airframe work. We can move all the engines to Tinker, and we can maybe just leave the Minuteman III out there. It'd be hard to move the Minuteman III off of Hill Air Force Base, but what do you employ, 1,200 people at the most? So you could cut it down to the size it would really be hurt, and it could happen. Someone has to have the knowledge, the guts, and know who to talk to make sure you get all these things squared away in Congress. And that's a lot of work. Someone's going to put a lot of work in. You'd be surprised how many consultants and lobbyists there are, probably more on base closing than any other issue. They get paid a lot of money. They do a lot of work, and many times it's a disaster. Mm. Used to come to my office, and I used to say, I think you're being paid an outrageous amount of money for what you do. But pointed out, it's almost a depression if this goes down. Mm. So sometimes you got to say, hey, we got to work hard to make sure this thing works.
Mm. You've been on a commission. You've been on the other side in Congress. What are the criteria that are used? Say you're sitting another time as a base realignment and closure commissioner. What are the criteria that are
I can't
used?
Remember all of them, but the first one is, there was eight of them, and the first one is needs of the military. And it has to be that. And number eight was the impact on the economy. And there's a lot in between roads and the whole thing, climate. You get into that. I remember one person saying, oh, we can't use Utah because of the Great Salt Lake. It rusts all our airplanes out. That's nonsense. There's no truth at all in that with either helicopters or airplanes. Needs of the area, that's what the people always say.
I remember I was the lead commissioner both in Allison in Alaska and in Clovis, New Mexico at Cannon. And the people, most of them talked about, well, you're going to hurt our community. In New Mexico, the governor, the two senators, everybody was there, and they all got up and testified that way. I felt like talking to them before and say, don't talk along that line. Tell us some of these ideas, how good your test and training range is, how good your workforce is, how many airplanes you can get out, how much do you get for every dollar you put in. We used to use that criteria. How much do you get? We pay you X amount of dollars. What kind of service do we get out of you? And then you average that over the group of them. Well, some of them were disasters. I don't know what they did. They sat around read Playboy, I guess, because we didn't get anything out of them. Where others really did well. And Hill always came out very, very well.
Mm. Turn back to Tage Flynn. We just have a minute or two left. What will your you talked about it a little bit at the beginning of the program. Reiterate that. What will your strategy be going forward? What will your arguments be? There's another round.
Well, our strategies are just right along the lines of what the congressman just said. We will take it on productivity and certainly promote the high productivity that's being created at the base by not only the civilian workforce but also the military workforce that currently sits there. We're going to look at it in terms of importance to the Air Force as a whole and their supply chain, which is very important to them, and the maintenance depot that maintains their airplanes. We have huge production numbers that the congressman just referred to, and so we're going to take it on that level. Just to be the number eight for us as well, the impacts to the state economy, because we know that doesn't play well when you're talking to a commission that's looking at bases all over the world. So our idea is to do that. We'll do that with probably not as many consultants as maybe some of the other places will do as well. We have an incredibly energized local group here that does this on a voluntary basis. It's really amazing to see what they can put together.
We're just about out of time. Just 30 seconds, Congressman. What do you think a likely timeline will be?
I think as close as you could come would be 2015. Mm-hmm. And they've got to change things around. I've been asked to help write the defense, the new bill that's going to do it. I guess they claim I'm the only guy in America who ever helped write the first one and then became a commissioner. Things I'm supposed to know more than I do.
Well, we'll keep an eye on this, obviously. Great impacts to Utah if it were to happen. Former Congressman Jim Hansen, thanks for joining us. And Tage Flynn, President of Utah Defense Alliance, thanks.
Thank you.
Don't forget, go to upr.org. Still tickets available for the From the Top event on the Weber State University campus tonight at 7:30. We're participating with that here at Utah Public Radio. Thanks to everyone involved. And we've been coming to you live from Ogden. Thanks for listening today.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan. Support for legislative coverage comes from USU's Department of Political Science, committed to improving the community, the state, the nation, and beyond, and supporting UPR's coverage of the Utah legislature. Information is at politicalscience.usu.edu.